The spectacular role of these glial molecules that I want to tell you about today, using qualitative arguments supplemented by some wonderful pictures of the crystal structures. Nominally, you might think that in fact, typically you should require some sort of help in folding in ciliary conditions because of the heavy traffic and lipids and salt concentrations and so on and so forth. I'm also mindful of the fact that around 3 o'clock or 3:10 we got to finish, and 3:15. For me, 16. Yeah. There's two classes of sort of chaperones one can talk about. One is called intermolecular chaperones, and these are chaperones which have been known for a while. For example, if you consider the folding of BPTI, which was referred to this morning by Michael Levitt, it turns out under in vitro conditions, it folds spontaneously, but there are off-pathway processes which act as kinetic traps that in fact will suck a lot of the flux out of the unfolded set of molecules. And in cells, there are things called protein disulfide isomerase, which in fact speed up the protein rates by about a factor of about 7,000, 8,000 and so on and so forth. That's avoiding these traps. I believe no one really knows how these things work, but happily I'm not going to talk about that. The set of molecules I am going to talk about are these class one chaperonins. And here, as I'll try to show you, that the chaperones actually play a very active role in actually rescuing the proteins from otherwise dead-end situations like aggregation and so on and so forth. The most famous of this, and the most well-studied, in fact, of this is one from E. coli, and they're called GRO-EL and GRO-ES. I think the GRO-E piece of it comes from some genetics. L just means large and S is small, and these two are the two chaperonin molecules I'll discuss. And I'll use the terminology substrate protein because it's a job of this machinery of GRO-EL and GRO-ES to rescue this substrate protein that is otherwise destined to become aggregates. Okay. So roughly speaking, this is what I want to cover, but I'll stop whenever I got to stop. The first one of the things one has to ask is the fact that we need chaperones in fact to rescue proteins mean that the Anfinsen hypothesis is incorrect? That is, it's got to be modified in some sense when you consider folding in vivo conditions. The answer apparently is not the case, and I'll show you a calculation using some numbers to show that, in fact, very small percentage of E. coli proteins at least require chaperonins. And in order to understand the framework of assisted folding, I'll review for you very qualitatively things that we learned by doing computations and how, in fact, spontaneous folding might occur in vitro conditions. And then I'll tell you a little bit about the GRO-EL and GRO-ES architecture. It's an absolutely splendid and a seductive molecule indeed, and that'll suggest a natural mechanism by which, in fact, GRO-ELs can assist folding. Then I'll introduce the complications of the fundamental cycle that's involved in the process of the GRO-EL, GRO-ES machinery and give rise to the so-called iterative annealing mechanism that George Lorimer and I announced about 5-6 years ago. The situation gets more complicated because the GRO-EL molecule, which is very large, undergoes a series of complicated allosteric transitions, and there are some couplings between these allosteric transitions and the substrate folding rates itself, which are just getting sorted out, and this, I believe, is largely an experimental in the experimental domain, is unless computers get fast by about 10 orders of magnitude, one can't touch these things. And there are speculations on mechanisms that I'll discuss, and there are some open questions for computational biology that we're sort of thinking about. So if nothing else, this is a very simple and interesting exercise to do. And the question one wants to ask is, what proportion of proteins in E. coli, for example, require chaperones? So this answer, of course, will depend upon the feeding conditions. And a typical feeding glucose medium, the cell doubling time is about 40 minutes. So every 40 minutes under normal glucose conditions, the strain will grow and double itself. The amount of protein in a cell which you can do by an extraction procedure is of the order of 10 to the minus 13 grams. And the average molecular weight the genome is completely known, the proteome at least, the length distribution is totally known. The average molecular weight is about 40,000 kilodaltons. So the number of polypeptide chains, given this is the average molecular weight, this is the total amount of proteins of the order of a million, couple of million. Total number of distinct proteins that's in the cell is about 2,000 to 4,000, depending upon who keeps account, and that's what this cell is. So the minimal rate of protein synthesis is just NP divided by tau D, which is about 60,000 polypeptide chains per minute. The number of ribosomes that actually make these proteins is per cell is about 35,000, which means every 35 seconds or so, this cell is putting out a polypeptide chain that needs to be folded, and then it's got to do whatever it's got to do. So you can also do these measurements under the photo strain. The percentage weight of GRO-EL per cell is about 1.35, from which you know the molecular weight of this GRO-EL is about 10 to the minus 15 grams. The GRO-ES machine, which is a smaller one cofactor, it's got that is 10 to the minus 16 grams of this. You know the mass of this of GRO-EL, and therefore the number of GRO-EL per cell is of the order of about 1,600 or so. And the number of GRO-ES by similar computation is about 3,100, and so they exist in a 2-to-1 ratio, and when you see the architecture of this machine, you'll immediately appreciate that stoichiometry is not by coincidence. Typically, one finds that if you regulate the folding of the substrate proteins in vitro, the GRO-EL-assisted folding rate is of the order of 1 or 2 per minute, and so the number of GRO-EL proteins that GRO-EL can actually process is simply the total number it has and the time it spends processing one protein, which is of the order of 1 per minute, and that's of the order of about, say, 2,000 to 3,000, which is much less than the number of proteins actually synthesized per minute by the cell. So this means that there simply isn't enough GRO-EL to go around to rescue every one of those proteins, and there's only a small fraction of these proteins that in fact need or should need for GRO-EL at all. So one of the questions you can ask is, since the percentage is very small, what will happen to the cell if you actually delete GRO-EL, delete the gene that produces GRO-EL, and that's a lethal operation, the cell will die, and so you do need this GRO-EL time around. So in fact, there are speculations that the GRO-EL must have originated rather early in the evolution in some sense, but these have not been shown. So this is I would normally show a slide of this, but please forgive me. One of the things that a protein folding experimentalist doing in vitro experiment doesn't show is yield as a function of temperature, for example. He says it folds at the rate of 100 milliseconds, 1 second, and so on. This we heard last week quite a lot from experimentalists, but one doesn't know how much yield there is. So here is an experiment on this protein called malate dehydrogenase, which apparently is a god-awful protein, and this is the yield as a function of temperature. This is under spontaneous conditions where the protein folding has been initiated by diluting out, say, some denaturant or the other as a function of temperature. And you see that under spontaneous conditions, under 37 degrees, you get about 30% or so yield. But when you add the chaperoning machinery of GRO-EL and GRO-ES, at 37 degrees corresponding to physiological conditions, the yield can be as high as 80%. So the focus, in fact, is not only to fold these proteins really rapidly or on biological time scale, but to fold enough of them so that you have sufficient yield to carry out whatever operation that is destined to be carried out by that given protein. So the yield is an important thing. And in fact, people working on the GRO-EL system are most concerned with the yield rather than the rate itself. So one of the things that I need to ask about, and I talked about the yield already, is how does a monomeric folding, the monomeric protein fold under in vitro conditions in the absence of GRO-EL, so that one can start to look at where the pitfalls could be that results in, say, aggregation processes and which would require the entire machinery of the EL and ES system.
Question, on the slide where you have the
chaperone
system, I'm wondering what the kinetics look like when you have a GRO-EL system, you get like basic kinetics? aspects, or is the overall rate speed up? I mean, how do things?
I will show you the results for BISCO, but it's a single exponential. And in fact, one of the things Henri did was to show, using some of the properties of the Gourier-Gourier system, to show that when you impose those conditions on the manifold of states, the population in the native state must increase exponentially, which is indeed what is found. But I'll show you experimental data. So these are some qualitative arguments. In fact, we came to these arguments not by thinking about this problem, but by looking at many computational models, and at the end it occurred to us that the scenario for the so-called kinetic partitioning mechanism that I'll describe in some detail, that actually Seb alluded to, could be obtained by some general arguments. Let's consider a polypeptide chain. This is my conception of this polypeptide chain, and you have the greens, I guess they should be blues, greens are the hydrophobic residues. And the initial driving force for this process is believed to be the hydrophobic collapse itself, which in fact is because the hydrophobic residues don't like the solvent, nominally water. It is known from analysis of PDB structures that about 50, the fraction of hydrophobic residues in protein is about 55% to 60%. Right? It's also known, in fact, you can do this computation, if you define a linear density of the distribution of the hydrophobic residues along the chain, contour length of the chain, they're quite uniform. And this has got to be so to get an architecture with a high density of core packings. As a result of the second statement that, in fact, if you look at any length scale which is more than 2 or 3 or 4 C-alpha carbon distance, you would find basically the same number of amino acids which are hydrophobic as you would in the entire length. So you can imagine under folding conditions, the proximal residues tend to form some local structures. In fact, when David Baker was discussing this idea that contact order might play an important role, because folding is probably nominally initiated by these local signals, one in the form, say, helices of some kind, the other turns, and so on and so forth. So from these local helices, the problem is still not solved, as the structure prediction is not finished once you specify the secondary structural elements, because there are many ways of actually forming, taking these secondary structural elements, which look pretty good, and forming some from so-called tertiary interactions. But among all those tertiary interactions, which produces various folds, only one or two qualifies as a candidate protein, in fact, lowest free energy for that particular sequence under those particular conditions. So the length scales that, or the structures that form on some short length scales are typically incompatible, not necessarily in the secondary structure sense, but lacking in the tertiary structures with the global fold, hence the system could be considered topologically frustrated. You cannot completely eliminate topological frustrations, even if you go to the extreme Go model that we've been hearing a lot about, which parenthetically I'm not a very big fan of, but you can't eliminate it because of the intrinsic connectivity of the polypeptide chains. You're really simply going to have this problem all the time. You can minimize that. That's why typically you find that the Go model actually folds much faster than your full models, but you can't eliminate it. But the real proteins have this real problem. They solve it somehow or the other. Therefore, there is an inherent frustration. We believe, and there's lots of computational evidence to show this, that the proteins that actually fold spontaneously are arranged in such a way that this frustration is minimized by having the so-called collapse temperature and the folding temperatures being proximal to each other, so that the chances of falling into any other states which are misfolded is in fact minimized. But I'm not going to talk about that. Typically then, if you construct these tertiary folds from these local structures, many of them would have quite high free energies, but some of them could in fact have sufficiently low free energy that they could start competing with the native basin of attraction in the process of folding itself. So generically then, one has a picture like this, that the underlying free energy landscape has many, I've seen this before many times, where The native basin of attraction is presumably the one of the deepest, but the volume of the native basin of attraction will depend upon the sequence and some other conditions which could presumably can be determined from looking at some models in statistical mechanics. There are a lot of these high free energy minima which are irrelevant because small fluctuations will drive them out of that into the native state, but there are some competing basins of attraction which could serve as traps. And in fact, if the time scale for escape of the traps is sufficiently large that they start competing with the other processes like aggregation, then such proteins would not fold spontaneously. They could to the native state of sufficient yield. So this is the general picture that one has. And if you have this sort of a landscape, and if you imagine what happens in a refolding experiment that you would do, or the ones in the black over here are the refolding experiments. I think Chow had a great idea. He would point like this, and so it's a great idea. And now I realize this. Start from these unfolded conformations. Some of them would, in fact, map on directly to the native basin of attraction, and the fraction of molecules that actually get there it would be the yield of the fast processes. And if the proteins fold spontaneously by having these characteristic temperatures close to each other, that landscape will look very much like a funnel, as they call it, and the population will simply grow, or the native state will grow exponentially. We'll have one simple barrier, perhaps, and that'll be the end of the story. And that's what really happens in the typically small size proteins. But if the protein has a full brunt of the topological frustration, such that you really have several competing bases of attraction that interfere, whose volume in this free energy landscape is large enough, then you would see that some fraction of molecules would in fact get here to one of these states, and then some on longer time scale fluctuations of some kind or the other will be involved, and this would involve typically an activated transition from, say, this basin of attraction to the native state, and that could take longer time than the spontaneous process in which it gets directly to the native state without any discernible intermediates. People think, ourselves included, that the very fast processes happen by the so-called nucleation collapse mechanism, but it's not relevant for what I want to tell you about today. So this is another generic diagram that you've seen for very spontaneous processes. Everything here is sloped to go to the native state, and that's the end. So now let's imagine the case, in fact, when one or two or more, and I'll in fact only talk about one, competing basin of attraction serve as off pathway or indirect process of reaching the native state. So the fraction of molecules that will go to the native state as a function of time can be simply written down from looking at this picture, and that'll simply be equal to phi, the yield, by the direct process times the time constant associated with the direct process, which say is by goes by a nucleation type mechanism, plus some other processes that take you from the competing basis of attraction to the native state, and I've labeled each competing basis of attraction by K. Typically, there are one or two or three. Yes? PU is a fraction of molecules that have not yet folded at time t. So 1 minus that will be the fraction that has folded. So in further considerations, I'm only going to consider k equals 1. I'll say there's one competing basin of attraction that interferes with the folding, and the rest of it is really fast. If phi is very large, say about 0.6 or 0.7, so that you have in the fast process sufficient amount of yield, there would be no need for chaperones. If p is very small, as could be the case for some proteins, you might require chaperones or at least alterations in conditions so that you can get sufficient yield. So this is the only thing that you need to know about spontaneous folding for the rest. Okay, this is just a summary. So first of all, what is the evidence for this kinetic partitioning? And I think you already heard this in the context of RNA before. And here are some experimental examples. Here is a protein, here is the yield of the direct process at some temperature and neutral pH. I think it's room temperature of a lysozyme. And Kiefhaber was the first to show, in fact, that this protein folds by the so-called kinetic partitioning involving fast and slow processes. And the amplitude of this fast process is over 15%, which means 15% of the molecules reach the native state quite rapidly in that particular instance in tens of milliseconds. The remaining population could be rescued if you just waited about 100 times longer, which is still much less than the biological time itself, and therefore the conditions under which lysozyme falls would be called permissive. Well, that one means that you don't really require any chaperones at all. If you wait long enough, 100 times about 10 or 20 milliseconds, about a second or so, you would get enough yield, and presumably these proteins in the E. coli system will not require any chaperones, period. And this is Rubisco, on the other hand, under normal physiological conditions, only 5% of the molecules actually fall spontaneously. Spontaneously means by the time you're looking at it, and if you look at it long enough, the protein actually precipitates out of solution. There are aggregation or other processes that have take place, there's some degradation of the protein, and these conditions under which you have an extremely small amount of yield would be called non-permissive, and typically chaperones are required only in the rescue of proteins under non-permissive conditions. And from now on, I'll assume that is in fact the case. In the ribozyme of the tetrahymena variety, I think Sarah Whitson talked about a couple of weeks ago, it turns out that about 8% of the molecules in fact reach the native state spontaneously, which means 90 or 92% get stuck, and there are speculations in fact that these tetrahymena might require chaperones, and the search for RNA chaperones has been around for a while. So the essential problem here, in fact, is the following. You have a native state, and you have one of these misfolded states. The time for rescue out of this misfolded state is comparable or greater than aggregation timescale or biologically relevant timescale, and the rescue of those proteins is crucially needed, and that's where the chaperones actually come in. Okay, so I want to tell you about the architecture of this spectacular machines. There are three issues involved when you consider the chaperone-assisted folding. Number one is you have to worry about the architecture of the molecule itself. It's very suggestive that there could be some obvious mechanisms by which the proteins are rescued. And we now know, I think the GROE-S crystal structure was determined, the GROE-L crystal structure was determined in 1994 by late Paul Siegler. The GROE-S structure was determined by somebody else a little bit later on, and in 1997, I'll show you a small picture of this, the complex GROE-L ADP7, the GROE-S structure, which I'll refer to as the R double prime state in a second, was determined by again Paul Siegler, who unfortunately passed away just last year. The other key player in this is the substrate protein itself, and there are typically, in the way I have described it to you, two time constants that you got to worry about, namely the fast time process and the slow time process from escape from the CBA. And the object of this guy is to make sure this actually folds in sufficient yield. And naturally, the coupling between all the shenanigans that the GROE-L system undergoes and the substrate folding rate itself makes this a very complicated problem to actually sort out. Architecture-wise, you mean?
Well, like you say, Rubisco.
Yes.
How many?
Oh, any in vitro, and I'll talk a little bit more about
any folding of any protein, or there is specific classes of protein?
Frankly, the answer is that in many instances, if you give the protein in unfolded form, it'll bind and it can assist folding. But that doesn't mean that's what happens in vivo conditions, okay? Because in vivo, experiments have been done to make completely random polypeptides from the library, and GROE-L and Philo recognize and bind to them, and presumably if they do have some state, they can get there, okay? But the fact they'll recognize anything is clear. So this is an absolutely stunning molecule, in fact. The GROE-L, the top piece of it is GROE-S. So it's a heptameric molecule stacked back to back. Okay, that's the grower yields. It's a 14 mer, if you will. If you look at it from the top, you can clearly see, you can go around and count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There's a sevenfold symmetry. In that domain of the sevenfold symmetry are the ATP binding sites. And ATP, in fact, binds to those sites. And so therefore, each time this molecule actually undergoes, and I'll explain the cycle in considerable detail, a turnover, it's an enzyme after all, turnover, it consumes ATP lavishly. There's 7 ATP that in fact fire away, producing about 49 kcals per mole, 7 kcals per mole. The dimensions of these two rings, this bottom ring and the top ring would exactly be the same, but in this case it's slightly different for reasons I'll come to in a second. So if you look at the dimensions, it's about 70 angstroms this way, it's about 40 or so angstroms, the hole is about 40 or so angstroms in the so-called relaxed state. Naturally, then this architecture suggests that perhaps the way this is working is that grower yield would rescue this sequester, these proteins which are destined to aggregate into this hole, into this cavity, acting like a test tube that will prevent interactions with other proteins, and that's how it spontaneously folds. This was a speculation before, this is the so-called Anfinsen cage hypothesis, that the grower yield affords Anfinsen, it's a cage in which the molecule in fact can sit and fold. Yes?
I'm surprised by sevenfold symmetry, and does the sevenfold symmetry, is it crucial, does it play any role?
In the class of chaperones themselves, uh-huh, there are molecules at 7 and 8-fold.
Eight-fold, and
there are some speculations, and perhaps you can comment on it, that this structure may be required because of some active role that'll play. Hopefully, I'll get to that.
It
may be required.
I see. You okay.
It's a speculative statement, I'll come to in a second. And GOES, in fact, in this R double prime complex, I'll refer to this as an R double prime complex, where it's ES, ES, and ADP. This is post-hydrolysis, ATP hydrolysis. The ES acts simply as a crown on top of it. So this architecture is an absolutely terrific. The sevenfold symmetry and all that kind of stuff. In fact, I will comment on that experiment a little bit later on. This crystal structure, of course, appeared 3 years before Paul's experiment, which appeared only last year. Very nice experiments, and those experiments, we're still digesting what that might mean. If I look at the volume, this is again. I'm sorry if you can't see this, but. If you look at the volume of this relaxed form of the grower yield molecule, it's about 85,000 angstrom cubed. Okay? So if I had this grower yield, two heptameric rings stacked back to back in the complete relaxed state, I'll have 85,000 angstrom cubed volume at the bottom, 85,000 angstrom cubed on the top. However, this shows that when a grower yield binds, and ATP hydrolysis has taken place, so that you get this complex ES-EL-ADP complex, the upper ring volume is expanded by a factor of 2. It's gone from 85,000 angstrom cubed to 175,000 angstrom cubed. This is a huge volume change that is involved in the process of encapsulation of this, of the substrate protein, and I'll talk a little bit more about this. There's a possibility of little water inside, but as you know, X-ray crystallography can tell you that very clearly, but there is room for that possibility. No, it is not fully a lot of water, which I'll get to in a bit. So I can do the math just as well. It's 175 divided by 9 angstrom cubed, be the total number of water molecules, but it's not a water-containing jug at all. So prior to this crystal structure, these are the images from Ellen Sable's lab, and you can basically see all the sections that you can see in the X-ray crystallography, and this is also made prior to the this crystal structure, where you can see the protein. We're now looking at from top of the molecule, and I think this is, I don't know what protein it is, it barely fits into the mouth of the cavity. Okay? So, one of the discussions that we've been having in the hallways with Mehran and others is, what can I do for these sorts of problems? It turns out that without knowing almost nothing about this, I proposed the initial steps of what this might happen. I was fortuitous that it was sort of right, and then I hooked up with an experimentalist to flush out the whole process. So this is the infants in cage model. Because it's not quite correct, I'm not going to talk about this. So this is something useful to keep in mind, that typically the radius of gyration of native states of proteins goes as n to the 1/3. This is what, in fact, Paul Flohr would have told us a long time ago, that it's a very maximally compact structure, nearly so. And the coefficient in front, in fact, is important because people have looked at a library of these proteins and tried to fit this, and it turns out this number, 4.75 times n to the 1/3, gives you the dimensions of a protein pretty well. Small angle X-ray scattering of the kind that Seb was talking about last week tells us that typically the molten globule, these intermediates, which in fact might require the chaperones, are larger than the native state by about 5 to 10%, and there's not much variation. There's 10-15%, something like that. The maximum volume of the infants in cage after the hydrolysis and so on, as I just showed you from the X-ray crystallography data, is 175,000 angstrom cubed. And if you approximate this via sphere, which clearly it isn't, then the radius of that would be about 35 angstroms. Rubisco, in its monomeric form, has 490 amino acid residues. And its molten globule dimensions are predicted to be about 32 angstroms. So if I shove this molecule, Rubisco, right down the throat of this expanded cavity, there's enough room for one layer of water molecule to float around in the expanded infant's cage. It's not clear there is that water molecule, but there's a possibility that exists. So it's a really quite tight fit indeed. Rubisco, in fact, does not fall as a monomer, it falls as an oligomer that takes place after the chaperone has actually kicked this out of the cage. Well, there are a number of interesting issues one can talk about. These are some of the lists, but I'll talk about the mechanism in a bit. There are some very simple kinetic constraints that very simple one that one has to satisfy. If a protein starts to fold, according to the mechanism I described to you, there are only two things that can happen to it. Some fraction of it, determined by phi, will go to the native state very rapidly. And one of the important things that I'm going to forget to tell you is that GroEL, the machine, the molecule, this particle, is highly promiscuous in the sense it'll interact with every polypeptide chain, as long as a polypeptide chain is not in the native state. So this suggests then that the typical interaction between the GroEL particle and the polypeptide chain is a hydrophobic-hydrophobic type interaction. It's non-specific completely. That's why even random polymers will in fact will bind to this. Non-native state presumably have most other, if not all, are the hydrophobic buried inside, and therefore their interaction is minimal. And once the native state is formed, GroEL will no longer recognize it, and this is out of the problem. The remaining fraction will go into one of the misfolded states, and it's clear if the aggregation time scale is very short, very high concentration before GroEL can capture it, then this is destined to become an aggregate, and therefore the minimum efficiency demands that the capture time be short enough compared to the aggregation time. This is an obvious kinetic constraint that needs to be imposed on the problem. So in 94, when I knew pretty much nothing about the subject. I know a little bit more now than I did then in 93. I knew that ATP hydrolysis was involved in this process, and I thought that is precisely kind of like the currency for the energy, and therefore this reminded me very much of the simulated annealing problem that we all learned before, and a thought came to me that perhaps a single function of the Grolier machine must be to act like a simulated annealing machine. And that is a conjecture I made, and the refinement of that through the experimental architecture is what I want to show you now. So this is a complicated thing, and I'm probably going to screw this up totally, so if you're interested, please interrupt. If not, I'm not going to be offended at all. So one starts from, in order to understand the cycle, it's really a thermodynamic cycle, and at the end of this, there are lots of people here who think about non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. You ought to realize that some of those can in fact be used profitably in this context, at least in some global description of this problem. So to understand the functioning of this machine, all you need to know is really worry about the fact that it's a single ring, and the double ring just complicates the problem a little bit, so I'll consider the fundamental process is simply the hemicycle. I start from the left-hand corner in a so-called T state. T stands for tense, and this terminology is borrowed from the Mano-Weimann-Changeul model used to describe cooperative binding of ligands to macromolecules. The T state is a state, perhaps what I should show you before I get to the cycle is the following. I'm always confused about what I should show first. Let me show you this slide. I think this is an important architectural feature to remember. What is drawn here is one subunit of the seven subunit that constitutes the Grolier particle. If I look at one subunit, it has an equatorial domain, and this is what the terminology is, and an apical domain and so-called intermediate domain. Most of the inertial mass of this is concentrated in the equatorial domain, so it's kind of like a dense mass that's just sort of fixed here, which is sort of what happens to us as we age, I suppose, and most of the mass is concentrated there. It's about two-thirds of the mass of the Grolier particle is in the equatorial domain. If I look at the apical domain, so I have a thing like this, the apical domain, and then if you look at, and in fact these are the picture in the red over there of the apical domain, if you look at the helices over there, there are two or three helices which are the hydrophobic residues kind of lined up inside as it were. So when I look at the molecule as a whole, the seven of the surrounded, the mouth of this molecule contains a lining of hydrophobic residues into which the misfolded protein can get ensnared. That's a capture process. Okay? It's that non-generic, non-specific recognition of the exposed hydrophobic residues within the mouth of the cavity that actually initiates this process. So I'll come back to this again a little bit later. So that's a tense state. The tense state has got a higher affinity for the substrate protein because of this lining of the apical domain has all the hydrophobic residues. So the initial steps involves is capture, and the substrate protein is now at the mouth of the cavity given by these apical domains. In this process, the molecular basis of exactly where things are going on is both an experimental and a computational study, but for our purposes it suffices. This process in which you have the substrate protein ensnared in the tense state up to this R prime state is a crucial power stroke of this machine where everything is done. Upon binding ATP, there is a transition from the T to the R state. The R state prefers the binding of ATP. The T state does not. The T state likes SP. The R state does not. Okay?
When you grow R, you can inject it out of
It isn't exactly like it's, it is. It, thanks, Duran. One second. Let's go around the cycle and tell exactly where, what the structures we know for sure are. The T state, the crystal structure is known. And then if you come around here, the crystal structure of the R double prime state is known. Okay? Clearly the R state doesn't look exactly like the T state. There's some differences, and those differences are in fact very important.
But in terms of the size of the cavity,
there, the R state, the size of the cavity is basically the same as the T state cavity. Not only the expansion only happens upon ES binding and so on. And so let's come back to that. Yeah.
In terms of just showing the audience what it looks like, it would be nice to draw R looking different.
Well, I have ATP and
R prime is different than R double prime. Because you're talking about conformations, right?
I'm talking about conformations. Yes. So let me come to this a bit. It is in fact the case that R state architecturally does not look like the T state insofar as one can tell from lots of things. Now, the transition from T to R can only be mediated upon ATP binding. Okay? It's a cooperative transition in which once you bind ATP, so I have this, the equatorial domain, I have this I intermediate domain. Upon binding ATP, it slams down on the equatorial domain by about 25 degrees, clamping down on all the ATP binding sites so that no more ATP can actually bind after that. One second. At physiological concentration, it's believed that all seven subunits on the equatorial domain will have ATP bound to that. Ciao.
Which side
is inside? The outside, the inside is really here, inside here. Okay? Okay, so there's a collapse of the intermediate domain onto the equatorial domain upon ATP binding. But that's not the end of the story, actually. So let's go back to this.
So there's this one thing you said, I just want to say, is that when you find ATP in the relaxed state, the bind energy for the SP protein is
increased or decreased? The binding of the R state, the binding of the substrate protein in R state is less, the binding constant, than it is in the T state. The reason is, when this hinge about the two amino acid residues, when the rotation takes place around this pro-137 glycine 410 of this I domain, there is some movement of this A domain that in fact hides the hydrophobic residues away from the outside, as it were, so the mouth is no longer lined as much with the hydrophobic residues as it is in the tense state.
So there's a chance of the substrate protein diffusing off before the ROES?
It can diffuse outside, you mean. That's unlikely because it's coming down, so that it'll cover it.
But the cavity is right on the small state, in which case it would be too small.
No, but the cavity is 85,000 angstrom cubed for many proteins that suffices. Rubisco was an extreme example that I showed you. Okay. Well, it depends on whether you're talking about the substrate or ATP. I can address it either ways, okay? All right. So I've chosen to call the tense state to be one that likes to bind the substrate protein but not ATP, and the R state the other way around. And in fact, if you want to ask me why I choose to call it that, you talk to Amnon Horowitz. He's the one who introduced this terminology this way. Okay? And it's perfectly sensible. It's just a terminology. So when you bind ATP and have induced a T to R transition, the interaction between the substrate protein and the walls of the cavity is less in this R state, and that's the first crucial observation, that is less in this R state than it is in the T state. So that the annealing activity of this machine can take place almost right away without any additional ES and so on and so forth binding. But under in vivo conditions, under in vitro conditions, many proteins can be made to fold without ES or ATP hydrolysis at all. Okay? And in particular, you can make mutants of this where there's no possibility of ATP, or you can add, it's a technical, okay. So then, the GRO-ES binds, the ES will not bind to this particle, to the R particle, until ATP is bound. So from now on, the cycle is only going in one direction. Over here, there's an allosteric equilibrium, studied most beautifully by Amnon Horowitz and Ofer Efrach in Weitzman over a period of about 7 or 8 years. And the whole allosteric transitions were sorted out by these two guys. Now AES binds, and once AES binds, the following absolutely spectacular conformational rearrangement takes place. So I have a system in which my base is here, okay, and imagine that I can show my equatorial domain has come down like this, and I have an apical domain sitting here, and this apical domain moves up by 60 degrees and twists by 90 degrees. Okay, it goes like this. In the process, the substrate protein no longer sees the hydrophobic interactions, it sees the other side of the helix, and because of the amphipathic patterns, it's going to see basically repulsive or hydrophobe polar type interactions, which is considerably less than the polar hydrophobe interactions. And this is the fundamentally important thing that is involved, that the system, by going through this absolutely large active conformational change, is showing to the substrate protein two different kinds of walls. One wall which is predominantly hydrophobic, with which it seduces the substrate protein inside, and then it encapsulates it, pushes it into the cavity if possible, by this large 90 degree twist and a 60 degree movement of the apical domain upwards. Okay. Without ES, that doesn't happen. It is upon this that there's a doubling of the volume cavity, because it's gone up and twisted out, generating a lot more room. Okay, doc? Okay. The R prime state now is conditioned for ATP hydrolysis, and all the ATP binding sites have been blocked. Hydrolysis takes place in a completely concerted fashion. If one guy fires, everybody else fires, and you go to this R double prime state, and this is the crystal structure that I showed you before. It's believed that R double prime and R prime state look basically the same, and after that, there's a release of the substrate protein GRO-ES, which requires communication between the upper and the lower ring, and that's the only place where you really need to know what the lower ring is doing, and if I have time, I'll discuss that. It does not care at all, and that's a key point, actually. It's a purely stochastic process. It is not a strict proofreading sense. It is a stochastic process. It doesn't care it's folded. It gives it a chance to fold, and according to the mechanism I described, it's got phi probability of folding, 1 minus phi of not folding, and if it doesn't happen, okay, so that's the next point I was going to make, and it now this from now on back to T state is basically the reverse of this. These are kicked out. We have an expanded version. Duran, if you will, this is probably what I should have shown for the R state, maybe. And then the apical domain collapses onto this. We are back to the T state, and the process can go on again.
So for Rubisco, if it's 5%, T is 5%.
You'll come to that. Trust me. There's an analysis I'll give you. So if the protein is not folded, the cycle repeats itself. Of course, there's another ring also, which I'm not going to discuss. Okay, that's a cycle. But let me point out the number of timescales in the cycle. There's those two timescales describing the allosteric transitions between the T to the R states. There are all these forward directions, KRR prime, there's a third and the fourth, and then these other timescales, taking it back from R prime to the T state. There were 5 or 6 timescales that you need to know to specify the cycle completely at a macroscopic level. And you got to worry about the fact that I've consumed enormous amount of ATP in going through the cycle. Yes?
What stage of the sort of spontaneous folding cycle does the protein actually enter or get on?
Yeah. So in the mechanism I described, it occurs on the stage when I have a misfolded intermediate, which has, at that stage, that's the one that it can recognize. Yeah. Okay. So this is basically the cycle, and this is essentially the initial mechanism that I thought about in 1993 in this nice Corsica, and it was published in 1994 in this god-awful book edited by Seb Doniak. Here is looking down on top of this sevenfold symmetry. The substrate protein here interacts with four subunits. There's no reason why it's interacted anymore. In fact, this is another topic of research among the experimentalists. Upon ATP hydrolysis, I have encapsulation. The protein can either do one of two things. It can fold or cannot fold. If it doesn't fold, Gruyere's will rebind. The cycle repeats itself until you get enough yield. Okay? So that's a basic iterative, I call it iterative simulated annealing mechanism, because that sounded like isam, which in Filipino means a kiss. But when I finally, George Lorimer told me there's nothing simulated about this. So we dropped S, which I regret having done. So this, of course, for physicists, is clear, is exactly like a simulated annealing mechanism, a simulated annealing. Incidentally, parenthetically, I want to tell you that in fact, affording this change from hydrophobic to hydrophil could in fact be a computational tool to fold some proteins as an annealing cycle that you could use instead of temperature alone. So this is something that one should try. That leads to unfolding, which if I have a chance, I'll show you. A global unfolding of the protein, or at least substantial unfolding of the protein, of the compact molten globular. Exactly. You're on a higher free energy surface. Excuse me? So this is I should have in fact mentioned this. One does not know the answer to that question. Thanks for talking about telling me that, because I knew there was something about the cycle I forgot. The time for this entire cycle, which is essentially given by the ATP hydrolysis timing cycle, is about 13 seconds, or 13 to 14 seconds. What fraction of this, how this is partitioned into hydrophobic and hydrophilic, one does not know. Can mutations actually govern this? One doesn't know. The experiments that Dan Hohen pointed out, Paul Hansmeier's, which in fact probed the lifetimes of Gruyere sitting on top of the Gruyere, on an average is about 7 seconds. It's getting kicked off in the CFM experiments. Okay? But there's a considerable dispersion of that. All one knows is the constraint, this is constant, how it's partitioned is not clear, and in fact it is one of these things that we actually did some computations on as well. I'm not going to have time to discuss all this, but we can certainly, I'll show you my transparencies if you wish. I think I lost something, no? Chow, you're responsible for, I know. It consumes ATP like a fiend. It's someone consumes alcohol. It just consumes like crazy. So substrate protein feels this hydrophobic wall for this time, and during this time there's no productive folding at all. This is an association with the apical domain of the protein. The substrate protein feels the hydrophilic wall for this much time. So we know from our kinetic partitioning mechanism that the fraction of molecules that have not folded, this is the productive time, has not folded, is simply given by this. Okay? I'm assuming there's only one competing basin of attraction. So now you can think of two scenarios, actually you can think of three scenarios. One is that the fast time scale, which is a nucleation time scale, is comparable to the productive folding time, which I don't know what it is, except that the sum is of the order of about 10 or 12 seconds. And that's much slower than this. And this is what is typically observed in Rubisco, because in Rubisco the slow time scale escape from this competing basin of attraction is so slow that aggregation takes over before it can fold, so this is the condition that's normally satisfied.
Staying in
you go back to the CPO report. So why do you call it by itself?
You want the aggregate.
You will aggregate and what?
This was not mentioned. So is that a disaggregation mechanism or is that?
It's not an aggregation mechanism. It is preventing aggregation and enabling this protein to fold by giving these annealing conditions. So if I put it just in water, that intermediate would just in all likelihood aggregate in some time.
But with the, so the idea from your question seems to be that being in contact with a hydrophilic wall is basically like being in contact with water. But if the hydrophilic effect is mostly an entropic effect, then the hydrophilic wall is not like water at all.
Look, in this case, the lining of the cavity in the tense state, which is purely hydrophobic, is the way that this molecule ensnares the protein from the outside. That's a recognition mechanism. Once it happens, then these other things go on.
But the question is, what is the protein folder that's next to it, I guess, a hydrophobic?
It does not. During the time it's in contact, the duration of which is tau sub h, it does not fold.
That's
tau sub p is a time when the wall is hydrophilic, so there's the repulse, basically it's a repulsive type interaction between the substrate. It's been released from the wall. The interaction has been minimized. Okay? During that condition, if it fits within the cavity, it is as though it's spontaneous folding without any possibility of aggregation. It can fold at some probability, it doesn't fold, and each time that thing turns over, the substrate protein gets kicked out, the deck is cleared before the next is initiated.
Yeah, but I'm just imagining a hydrophilic wall that I'm seeing all these charges and all these things there.
There are no charges inside the wall, they're outside.
In the hydrophilic section?
In the hydrophilic, there are polar residues and charges.
Polar residues and charges. And I'm trying to think that if I have these polar residues and charges, I have all of my hydrogen body centers and donors in my backbone chain, I have all of my charge groups and things like that. So it would seem that would be something where it would just as likely...
No. So the key thing is once this happens, the protein is essentially... I will talk about the fact that there's a movement of the subunits which essentially has to leave the protein for a little bit of time before any interactions of the protein can take place, and within the time scale, that system can either partition or not partition.
The question is whether it's really a monomerization mechanism that is preventing from aggregating / oligomer formation in water by virtue of a misfolded protein being hydrophobic outside, therefore aggregating with each other.
Yes. Or it prevents that channel for sure.
So this is understood.
Yeah.
But what they are saying, there may be a different explanation, and that is that there is something different about just being in water as opposed to feeling hydrophobic for a short time, and then suddenly there is sort of a hydrophilic shock without the properties that usually are associated with being in water, which will then...
Well, from the point of substrate protein, which is what I'm interested in, I want to keep my eye on the ball, it's a substrate protein that I'm interested in. Once I'm released from the hydrophobic wall, I can partition to the native state or to the misfolded state in a time scale which is very short before any contacts with anything else can take place.
Separate from what you are saying now.
We can discuss this later. Yeah. Okay. all right. So the arithmetic for this is here. And okay. So then in n cycles, which is n ATP hydrolysis has been consumed, the yield in fact will go like this. It's a very simple arithmetic. And for Rubisco, this is 0.05, you need about 20 cycles. I think this should be 0.7, I think. So if you do 20 rounds of hydrolysis and subject this protein to this, you'll get a yield of about 70%. And of course, in that process, you'd have consumed about 140 ATP molecules, which is a gigantic amount of energy. Right, but the amount of energy required to synthesize Rubisco to begin with is gigantically large, and this 140 molecules turns out to be only about 5% of the amount of energy spent in synthesizing Rubisco, and therefore this is a very small insurance to pay to ensure that it folds properly. 7 ATP hydrolysis, because there's 7 subunits, there are 20 cycles that are required to produce an yield of about 70%, so it's total is 7 times 20.
Each cycle is 13 seconds.
Each cycle lasts for about 13 seconds.
So it's 2 minutes.
Exactly, right.
Is that 5 or 0.5?
It is 0.05. 0.05. So here is what I promised Richard earlier. This is an experiment, in fact. This is an nanomolar of Rubisco that is folded as a function of time. Henri, as you see, the time is, in fact, in tens of minutes. And this is the concentration of Gruyel. All these curves can be fit by a single exponential. And this is what Arlan told me a long time ago, that if you make the condition that the Gruyel molecule does not recognize the native state, he can set up a master equation, and just with that condition alone, the probability of occupation of the native state, the P0 for example, is always got to be exponential, no matter what the distribution of the misfolded states are.
I'm just wondering, if the fact that we increase the concentration of Gruyel,
yes,
that you're in these conditions,
you have most of your substrate protein is not associated with Gruyel at any given time. Say it again? No, this is so if you have no Gruyel is over here, and then you go up this from here to here is stoichiometric, here is 1-to-1 stoichiometric. So the second condition, I gotta stop pretty soon, right?
Inside the Gruyel.
There is no guarantee that it does not take place. All one knows is the substrate protein. It doesn't violate anything that I said. It doesn't take place. It depends upon the size. It
so
could come.
Due to the time scale, it could well be
that. It does. That, but as long as the ATP has taken place, so that you have introduced a T to R transition, it is like an annealing machine. It could take place. So this is the second scenario one can think about, and apparently there are no in vitro examples of this kind. So here one is considering that the fast time scale of the spontaneous folding is much smaller than the productive time, which is a time scale in which the wall is hydrophilic, and that's comparable to the time scale needed to get out of the competing basin of attraction. You can go through the arithmetic and show that the yield in this case will be, instead of 1 minus, there's an additional factor E at the bottom to the power of N, and therefore if it followed this mechanism, a particular substrate protein, and even if phi was just 5%, in about 2 iterations you can get about 80-85% of the yield, and you would consume much less ATP. There are no in vitro examples of such a scenario so far. So this is a plausible speculation as to why maybe a ring structure could be involved. Tony, wake you up from your calculation. imagine that you have a ring sitting here, and the substrate protein is actually keep writing. and the substrate protein is actually pinned between two adjacent units as it is here. Here is one adjacent unit, another here is another adjacent unit, subunit. Okay? So there are 7 circles, and the 2 circles are initially 25 angstroms apart. Now, it's speculated that this unfolding that I attributed to is actually force-induced in some sense. The way that force is generated is like this. So I have this protein, and I'm hanging on to this, and I have this rotating upwards and twist like this, and that generates essentially a force, and the efficient geometry perhaps to generate that force is in fact a circle when I look down on top of this. If it were anything else, the motion of the subunit would be much larger than is warranted, and that would not lead to an efficient generation of force. So upon the transition from going from the T to R double prime, this two substrate that are initially pinned by 25 angstroms, have moved apart by about 33 angstroms, which is a substantial departure. And if the substrate proteins were pinned diagonally, they could in fact move apart even further. And this generates a force on this molecule, and we now know that in fact if you apply sufficient force, the protein can actually unfold. And let me do that calculation, and I think I'll stop because this whole thing that is just too much time for me to take, so I'm going to stop, right? Because I have some set of things to show between the coupling between LS3 and so on. I may mention that. So this is basically, I assume that they're pinned in A and B here initially, ATP, and this transition is taking place, and the total amount, in fact, that is gone is basically, you can do this geometry, is about two angstroms or so, 2, 5, 6 angstroms. So the amount of force that you may want to estimate, the stretching force, is something like kT or 2 kT or 3 kT is divided by this delta x. This would be called the Pincus force, because he did the opposite for the Pincus blobs, as you know, were the opposite. Anyway, the stretching force would be estimated to be about 20 to 30 to 40 piconewtons. If you looked at the experiments, the AFM experiments on Titan, the muscle protein, and others, the typical proteins, forces that are required to unfold such proteins are of the order of 150 to 200 piconewtons, which are considerably larger than what seems to be plausibly generated by this limited motion in this ring. There's a coupling of ATP involved in this earth, but ATP hydrolysis has not taken place yet. So it's prior to the ATP hydrolysis. It's only in the T to R state that I'm computing this. So larger force could in fact be generated in the other powers tenfold very easily. But the other thing to notice is that the reason this computation was done is because there are many in vitro proteins that can be made to fold in the absence of ES, and even there's a dynamic role played by this domain motion, and that will lead to forces of this magnitude. Now, the typical pulling speed in these AFM experiments, which generates large forces, is the order of 1 micron per second or so. The pulling speed over here, dimensionally, would be about 5, 4, 5, 6 orders of magnitude less, and we know that this is a near equilibrium pulling, if you will, in the T to R transition, and that's why the diminished value of this magnitude is sufficient to unfold this, if not globally, at least locally, for this to be put on a higher free energy surface and the mechanism to go on. I want to show one last thing, and that's it. I'm already way beyond time. I know that this is again a plug for this very beautiful experiment and my very pleasurable visit with Amnon Horowitz and his postdoc. And here is, this is just sort of, the sort of work is just beginning. I talked about the substrate protein independently. I talked about the GRO-EL separately, but all these transitions are coupled. And here is the experiment in which this coupling has been for the first time measured, following some computations that I didn't tell you about, in which we predicted that as the cooperativity, as the equilibrium constant between the T to R transition is increased, so that the R state is more facile than the T state, the rate of substrate folding should decrease, and that's what we showed. And when I had this conversation with Amnon, he did these experiments, and these are the experiments from the so-called murine DHFR dihydrofolate reductase, and these are the various mutants of the GRO-EL machine, and there's a rate as a function of essentially measuring the equilibrium constant indicated by the so-called Hill plot, that in fact the rate decreases as the cooperativity increases, just like this prediction that we made. But in order to fully understand how these various other timescales are coupled to the substrate protein, one has to sort this out. And here is where some equilibrium statistical mechanics, non-equilibrium statistical mechanics might be of use. I got plenty more to talk about, but my time is up.